more independent or more skeptical thinker might have had different views on the matter. In a quite constant way, Orientalism depends for its strategy on this flexible, positional superiority, which puts the Westerner in a whole series of possible relationships with the Orient without ever losing him the relative upper hand. And why should it have been otherwise, especially during the period of extraordinary European ascendancy from the late Renaissance to the present? The scientist, the scholar, the missionary, the trader, or the soldier was in or thought about the Orient because he could be there, or could think about it, with very little resistance on the Orient's part. Under the general heading of knowledge of the Orient, and within the umbrella of Western hegemony over the Orient during the period from the end of the 18th century, there emerged a complex Orient suitable for study in the academy, for display in the museum, for reconstruction in the colonial office, for theoretical illustration in anthropological, biological, linguistic, racial, and historical theses about mankind and the universe, for instances of economic and sociological theories of development, revolution, cultural personality, national or religious character. Additionally, the imaginative examination of things Oriental was based more or less exclusively upon a sovereign Western consciousness out of whose unchallenged centrality an Oriental world emerged, first according to general ideas about who or what was an Oriental, then according to a detailed logic governed not simply by empirical reality, but by a battery of desires, repressions, investments, and projections. If we can point to great Orientalist works of genuine scholarship like Sylvestre de Sacy's Chrestomathie Arabe, or Edward William Lane's Account of the Manners and Customs of the Modern Egyptians, we need also to note that Renan's and Gobineau's racial ideas came out of the same impulse, as did a great many Victorian pornographic novels. See the analysis by Stephen Marcus of The Lustful Turk. And yet, one must repeatedly ask oneself whether what matters in Orientalism is the general group of ideas overriding the mass of material, about which who could deny that they were shot through with doctrines of European superiority, various kinds of racism, imperialism, and the like, dogmatic views of the Oriental as a kind of ideal and unchanging abstraction, or the much more varied work produced by almost uncountable individual writers, whom one would take up as individual instances of authors dealing with the Orient. In a sense, the two alternatives, general and particular, are really two perspectives on the same material. In both instances, one would have to deal with pioneers in the field like William Jones, with great artists like Nerval or Flaubert. And why would it not be possible to employ both perspectives together, or one after the other? Isn't there an obvious danger of distortion, of precisely the kind that academic Orientalism has always been prone to, if either too general or too specific a level of description is maintained systematically? My two fears are distortion and inaccuracy, or rather, the kind of inaccuracy produced by too dogmatic a generality and too positivistic a localized focus. In trying to deal with these problems, I have tried to deal with three main aspects of my own contemporary reality that seem to me to point the way out of the methodological or perspectival difficulties I have been discussing, difficulties that might force one, in the first instance, into writing a coarse polemic on so unacceptably general a level of description as not to be worth the effort, or in the second instance, into writing so detailed and atomistic a series of analyses as to lose all track of the general lines of force informing the field, giving it its special cogency. How, then, to recognize individuality and to reconcile it with its intelligent, and by no means passive or merely dictatorial, general and hegemonic context. 3. I mentioned three aspects of my contemporary reality. I must explain and briefly discuss them now so that it can be seen how I was led to a particular course of research and writing. 1. The distinction between pure and political knowledge. It is very easy to argue that knowledge about Shakespeare or Wordsworth is not political, whereas knowledge about contemporary China or the Soviet Union is. My own formal and professional designation is that of humanist, a title which indicates the humanities as my field, and therefore the unlikely eventuality that there might be anything political about what I do in that field. Of course, all these labels and terms are quite unnuanced as I use them here, but the general truth of what I am pointing to is, I think, widely held. One reason for saying that a humanist who writes about Wordsworth or an editor whose specialty is Keats is not involved in anything political is that what he does seems to have no direct political effect upon reality in the everyday sense. A scholar whose field is Soviet economics works in a highly charged area where there is much government interest, and what he might produce in the way of studies or proposals will be taken up by policymakers, government officials, institutional economists, intelligence experts. The distinction between humanists and persons whose work has policy implications or political significance can be broadened further by saying that the former's ideological color is a matter of incidental importance to politics, although possibly of great moment to his colleagues in the field, who may object to his Stalinism or fascism or to easy liberalism, whereas the ideology of the latter is woven directly into his material. Indeed, economics, politics, and sociology in the modern academy are ideological sciences, and therefore taken for granted as being political. Nevertheless, the determining impingement on most knowledge produced in the contemporary West, and here I speak mainly about the United States, is that it be non-political, that is, scholarly, academic, impartial, above partisan or small-minded doctrinal belief. One can have no quarrel with such an ambition in theory, perhaps, but in practice the reality is much more problematic. No one has ever devised a method for detaching the scholar from the circumstances of life, from the fact of his involvement, conscious or unconscious, with a class, a set of beliefs, a social position, or from the mere activity of being a member of a society. These continue to bear on what he does professionally, even though naturally enough his research and its fruits do attempt to reach a level of relative freedom from the inhibitions and the restrictions of brute, everyday reality. For there is such a thing as knowledge that is less, rather than more, partial than the individual, with his entangling and distracting life circumstances, who produces it. Yet this knowledge is not therefore automatically non-political. Whether discussions of literature or of classical philology are fraught with or have unmediated political significance is a very large question that I have tried to treat in some detail elsewhere. What I am interested in doing now is suggesting how the general liberal consensus that true knowledge is fundamentally non-political, and conversely that overtly political knowledge is not true knowledge, obscures the highly, if obscurely organized, political circumstances obtaining when knowledge is produced. No one is helped in understanding this today when the adjective political is used as a label to discredit any work for daring to violate the protocol of pretended supra-political objectivity. We may say, first, that civil society recognizes a gradation of political importance in the various fields of knowledge. To some extent, the political importance given a field comes from the possibility of its direct translation into economic terms. But, to a greater extent, political importance comes from the closeness of a field to ascertainable sources of power in political society. Thus, an economic study of long-term Soviet energy potential and its effect on military capability is likely to be commissioned by the Defense Department, and thereafter to acquire a kind of political status impossible for a study of Tolstoy's early fiction, financed in part by a foundation. Yet both works belong in what civil society acknowledges to be a similar field, Russian studies, even though one work may be done by a very conservative economist, the other by a radical literary historian. My point here is that Russia, as a general subject matter, has political priority over nicer distinctions such as economics and literary history, because political society, in Gramsci's sense, reaches into such realms of civil society as the academy and saturates them with significance of direct concern to it. I do not want to press all this any further on general theoretical grounds. It seems to me that the value and credibility of my case can be demonstrated by being much more specific, in the way, for example, Noam Chomsky has studied the instrumental connection between the Vietnam War and the notion of objective scholarship as it was applied to cover state-sponsored military research. Now, because Britain, France, and recently the United States are imperial powers, their political societies impart to their civil societies a sense of urgency, a direct political infusion, as it were, where and whenever matters pertaining to their imperial interests abroad are concerned. I doubt that it is controversial, for example, to say that an Englishman in India or Egypt in the later 19th century took an interest in those countries that was never far from their status in his mind as British colonies. To say this may seem quite different from saying that all academic knowledge about India and Egypt is somehow tinged and impressed with, violated by, the gross political fact, and yet that is what I am saying in this study of Orientalism. For if it is true that no production of knowledge in the human sciences can ever ignore or disclaim its author's involvement as a human subject in his own circumstances, then it must also be true that for a European or American studying the Orient, there can be no disclaiming the main circumstances of his actuality. That he comes up against the Orient as a European or American first, as an individual second. And to be a European or an American in such a situation is by no means an inert fact. It meant and means being aware, however dimly, that one belongs to a power with definite interests in the Orient, and, more important, that one belongs to a part of the earth with a definite history of involvement in the Orient almost since the time of Homer. Put in this way, these political actualities are still too undefined and general to be really interesting. Anyone would agree to them without necessarily agreeing also that they mattered very much, for instance, to Flaubert as he wrote Salammbô, or to H.A.R. Gibb as he wrote Modern Trends in Islam. The trouble is that there is too great a distance between the big dominating fact, as I have described it, and the details of everyday life that govern the minute discipline of a novel or a scholarly text as each is being written. Yet if we eliminate from the start any notion that big facts like imperial domination can be applied mechanically and deterministically to such complex matters as culture and ideas, then we will begin to approach an interesting kind of study. My idea is that European and then American interest in the Orient was political according to some of the obvious historical accounts of it that I have given here, but that it was the culture that created that interest, that acted dynamically along with brute political, economic, and military rationales to make the Orient the varied and complicated place that it obviously was in the field I call Orientalism. Therefore, Orientalism is not a mere political subject matter or field that is reflected passively by culture, scholarship, or institutions, nor is it a large and diffuse collection of texts about the Orient, nor is it representative and expressive of some nefarious Western imperialist plot to hold down the Oriental world. It is, rather, a distribution of geopolitical awareness into aesthetic, scholarly, economic, sociological, historical, and philological texts. It is an elaboration, not only of a basic geographical distinction. The world is made up of two unequal halves, Orient and Occident, but also of a whole series of interests which, by such means as scholarly discovery, philological reconstruction, psychological analysis, landscape and sociological description, it not only creates but also maintains, it is, rather than expresses, a certain will or intention to understand, in some cases to control, manipulate, even to incorporate, what is a manifestly different or alternative and novel world. It is, above all, a discourse that is by no means in direct corresponding relationship with political power in the raw, but rather is produced and exists in an uneven exchange with various kinds of power, shaped to a degree by the exchange with power political, as with a colonial or imperial establishment, power intellectual, as with reigning sciences like comparative linguistics or anatomy, or any of the modern policy sciences, power cultural, as with orthodoxies and canons of taste, texts, values, power moral, as with ideas about what we do and what they cannot do or understand as we do. Indeed, my real argument is that Orientalism is, and does not simply represent, a considerable dimension of modern political intellectual culture, and as such, has less to do with the Orient than it does with our world. Because Orientalism is a cultural and a political fact, then, it does not exist in some archival vacuum. Quite the contrary, I think it can be shown that what is thought, said, or even done about the Orient follows, perhaps occurs within, certain distinct and intellectually knowable lines. Here, too, a considerable degree of nuance and elaboration can be seen working as between the broad superstructural pressures and the details of composition, the facts of textuality. Most humanistic scholars are, I think, perfectly happy with the notion that texts exist in contexts, that there is such a thing as intertextuality, that the pressures of conventions, predecessors, and rhetorical styles limit what Walter Benjamin once called the overtaxing of the productive person in the name of the principle of creativity, in which the poet is believed on his own and out of his pure mind to have brought forth his work. Yet there is a reluctance to allow that political, institutional, and ideological constraints act in the same manner on the individual author. A humanist will believe it to be an interesting fact to any interpreter of Balzac that he was influenced in the Comédie Humaine by the conflict between Geoffroy Saint-Hilaire and Cuvier. But the same sort of pressure on Balzac of deeply reactionary monarchism is felt in some vague way to demean his literary genius and therefore to be less worth serious study. Similarly, as Harry Bracken has been tirelessly showing, philosophers will conduct their discussions of Locke, Hume, and empiricism without ever taking into account that there is an explicit connection in these classic writers between their philosophic doctrines and racial theory, justifications of slavery, or arguments for colonial exploitation. These are common enough ways by which contemporary scholarship keeps itself pure. Perhaps it is true that most attempts to rub culture's nose in the mud of politics have been crudely iconoclastic. Perhaps also the social interpretation of literature in my own field has simply not kept up with the enormous technical advances in detailed textual analysis. But there is no getting away from the fact that literary studies in general, and American Marxist theorists in particular, have avoided the effort of seriously bridging the gap between the superstructural and the base levels in textual, historical scholarship. On another occasion, I have gone so far as to say that the literary cultural establishment as a whole has declared the serious study of imperialism and culture off-limits. for Orientalism brings one up directly against that question, that is, to realizing that political imperialism governs an entire field of study, imagination, and scholarly institutions in such a way as to make its avoidance an intellectual and historical impossibility. Yet there will always remain the perennial escape mechanism of saying that a literary scholar and a philosopher, for example, are trained in literature and philosophy respectively, not in politics or ideological analysis. In other words, the specialist argument can work quite effectively to block the larger and, in my opinion, the more intellectually serious perspective. Here, it seems to me, there is a simple two-part answer to be given, at least so far as the study of imperialism and culture, or Orientalism, is concerned. In the first place, nearly every 19th century writer, and the same is true enough of writers in earlier periods, was extraordinarily well aware of the fact of empire. This is a subject not very well studied, but it will not take a modern Victorian specialist long to admit that liberal cultural heroes like John Stuart Mill, Arnold, Carlyle, Newman, Macaulay, Ruskin, George Eliot, and even Dickens had definite views on race and imperialism, which are quite easily to be found at work in their writing. So, even a specialist must deal with the knowledge that Mill, for example, made it clear in On Liberty and Representative Government that his views there could not be applied to India. He was an India Office functionary for a good deal of his life, after all, because the Indians were civilizationally, if not racially, inferior. The same kind of paradox is to be found in Marx, as I try to show in this book. In the second place, to believe that politics in the form of imperialism bears upon the production of literature, scholarship, social theory, and history writing is by no means equivalent to saying that culture is therefore a demeaned or denigrated thing. Quite the contrary. My whole point is to say that we can better understand the persistence and the durability of saturating hegemonic systems like culture when we realize that their internal constraints upon writers and thinkers were productive, not unilaterally inhibiting. It is this idea that Gramsci, certainly, and Foucault and Raymond Williams, in their very different ways, have been trying to illustrate. Even one or two pages by Williams on The Uses of the Empire in The Long Revolution tell us more about 19th century cultural richness than many volumes of hermetic textual analyses. Therefore, I study Orientalism as a dynamic exchange between individual authors and the large political concerns shaped by the three great empires, British, French, American, in whose intellectual and imaginative territory the writing was produced. What interests me most as a scholar is not the gross political verity, but the detail, as indeed what interests us in someone like Lane or Flaubert or Renan is not the, to him, indisputable truth that Occidentals are superior to Orientals, but the profoundly worked over and modulated evidence of his detailed work within the very wide space opened up by that truth. One need only remember that Lane's Manners and Customs of the Modern Egyptians is a classic of historical and anthropological observation because of its style, its enormously intelligent and brilliant details, not because of its simple reflection of racial superiority, to understand what I am saying here. The kind of political questions raised by Orientalism, then, are as follows. What other sorts of intellectual, aesthetic, scholarly and cultural energies went into the making of an imperialist tradition like the Orientalist one? How did philology, lexicography, history, biology, political and economic theory, novel writing, and lyric poetry come to the service of Orientalism's broadly imperialist view of the world? What changes, modulations, refinements, even revolutions take place within Orientalism? What is the meaning of originality, of continuity, of individuality in this context? How does Orientalism transmit or reproduce itself from one epoch to another? In fine, how can we treat the cultural, historical phenomenon of Orientalism as a kind of willed human work, not of mere unconditioned ratiocination, in all its historical complexity, detail, and worth, without at the same time losing sight of the alliance between cultural work, political tendencies, the state, and the specific realities of domination? Governed by such concerns, a humanistic study can responsibly address itself to politics and culture. But this is not to say that such a study establishes a hard and fast rule about the relationship between knowledge and politics. My argument is that each humanistic investigation must formulate the nature of that connection in the specific context of the study, the subject matter, and its historical circumstances. 2. The methodological question. In a previous book, I gave a good deal of thought and analysis to the methodological importance for work in the human sciences of finding and formulating a first step, a point of departure, a beginning principle. A major lesson I learned and tried to present was that there is no such thing as a merely given or simply available starting point. Beginnings have to be made for each project in such a way as to enable what follows from them. Nowhere, in my experience, has the difficulty of this lesson been more consciously lived, with what success or failure I cannot really say, than in this study of Orientalism. The idea of beginning, indeed the act of beginning, necessarily involves an act of delimitation by which something is cut out of a great mass of material, separated from the mass, and made to stand for, as well as be, a starting point, a beginning. For the student of texts, one such notion of inaugural delimitation is Louis Althusser's idea of the problematic, a specific determinate unity of a text or group of texts which is something given rise to by analysis. Yet in the case of Orientalism, as opposed to the case of Marx's texts, which is what Althusser studies, there is not simply the problem of finding a point of departure, or problematic, but also the question of designating which texts, authors, and periods are the ones best suited for study. It has seemed to me foolish to attempt an encyclopedic narrative history of Orientalism, first of all, because if my guiding principle was to be the European idea of the Orient, there would be virtually no limit to the material I would have had to deal with. Second, because the narrative model itself did not suit my descriptive and political interests. Third, because in such books as Raymond Schwab's La Renaissance Orientale, Johann Fuchs' Die Arabischen Studien in Europa bis in den Anfang des 20. Jahrhunderts, and more recently, Dorothee Metzlitzki's The Matter of Araby in Medieval England, there already exist encyclopedic works on certain aspects of the European-Oriental encounter, such as make the critic's job, in the general political and intellectual context I sketched above, a different one. There still remained the problem of cutting down a very fat archive to manageable dimensions, and more important, outlining something in the nature of an intellectual order within that group of texts, without at the same time following a mindlessly chronological order. My starting point, therefore, has been the British, French, and American experience of the Orient taken as a unit, what made that experience possible by way of historical and intellectual background, what the quality and character of the experience has been. For reasons I shall discuss presently, I limited, that already limited, but still inordinately large set of questions, to the Anglo-French-American experience of the Arabs and Islam, which for almost 1,000 years together stood for the Orient. Immediately upon doing that, a large part of the Orient seems to have been eliminated. India, Japan, China, and other sections of the Far East, not because these regions were not important, they obviously have been, but because one could discuss Europe's experience of the Near Orient or of Islam, apart from its experience of the Far Orient. Yet, at certain moments of that general European history of interest in the East, particular parts of the Orient, like Egypt, Syria, and Arabia, cannot be discussed without also studying Europe's involvement in the more distant parts, of which Persia and India are the most important. A notable case in point is the connection between Egypt and India so far as 18th and 19th century Britain was concerned. Similarly, the French role in deciphering the Zend Avesta, the preeminence of Paris as a center of Sanskrit studies during the first decade of the 19th century, the fact that Napoleon's interest in the Orient was contingent upon his sense of the British role in India, all these Far Eastern interests directly influenced French interest in the Near East, Islam, and the Arabs. Britain and France dominated the Eastern Mediterranean from about the end of the 17th century on. Yet, my discussion of that domination and systematic interest does not do justice to A. the important contributions to Orientalism of Germany, Italy, Russia, Spain, and Portugal, and B. the fact that one of the important impulses toward the study of the Orient in the 18th century was the revolution in biblical studies, stimulated by such variously interesting pioneers as Bishop Loth, Eichhorn, Herder, and Michaelis. In the first place, I had to focus rigorously upon the British, French, and later the American material because it seemed inescapably true not only that Britain and France were the pioneer nations in the Orient and in Oriental studies, but that these vanguard positions were held by virtue of the two greatest colonial networks in pre-20th century history. The American Oriental position since World War II has fit, I think quite self-consciously, in the places excavated by the two earlier European powers. Then, too, I believe that the sheer quality, consistency, and mass of British, French, and American writing on the Orient lifts it above the doubtless crucial work done in Germany, Italy, Russia, and elsewhere. But I think it is also true that the major steps in Oriental scholarship were first taken in either Britain and France, then elaborated upon by Germans. Sylvestre de Sacy, for example, was not only the first modern and institutional European Orientalist who worked on Islam, Arabic literature, the Druze religion, and Sassanid Persia. He was also the teacher of Champollion and of Franz Popp, the founder of German comparative linguistics. A similar claim of priority and subsequent preeminence can be made for William Jones and Edward William Lane. In the second place, and here the failings of my study of Orientalism are amply made up for, there has been some important recent work on the background in biblical scholarship to the rise of what I have called modern Orientalism. The best and the most illuminatingly relevant is E.S. Schaeffer's impressive Kubla Khan and the Fall of Jerusalem, an indispensable study of the origins of Romanticism and of the intellectual activity underpinning a great deal of what goes on in Coleridge, Browning, and George Eliot. To some degree, Schaeffer's work refines upon the outlines provided in Schwab by articulating the material of relevance to be found in the German biblical scholars and using that material to read, in an intelligent and always interesting way, the work of three major British writers. Yet what is missing in the book is some sense of the political as well as ideological edge given the Oriental material by the British and French writers I am principally concerned with. In addition, unlike Schaeffer, I attempt to elucidate subsequent developments in academic as well as literary Orientalism that bear on the connection between British and French Orientalism on the one hand, and the rise of an explicitly colonial-minded imperialism on the other. Then, too, I wish to show how all these earlier matters are reproduced more or less in American Orientalism after the Second World War. Nevertheless, there is a possibly misleading aspect to my study, where, aside from an occasional reference, I do not exhaustively discuss the German developments after the inaugural period dominated by Sacy. Any work that seeks to provide an understanding of academic Orientalism and pays little attention to scholars like Steinthal, Müller, Becker, Goldzieher, Brockelmann, Nöldecke, to mention only a handful, needs to be reproached, and I freely reproach myself. I particularly regret not taking more account of the great scientific prestige that accrued to German scholarship by the middle of the 19th century, whose neglect was made into a denunciation of insular British scholars by George Eliot. I have in mind Eliot's unforgettable portrait of Mr. Casaubon in Middlemarch. One reason Casaubon cannot finish his Key to All Mythologies is, according to his young cousin Will Ladislaw, that he is unacquainted with German scholarship. For not only has Casaubon chosen a subject as changing as chemistry, new discoveries are constantly making new points of view, he is undertaking a job similar to a refutation of Paracelsus because he is not an Orientalist, you know. Eliot was not wrong in implying that by about 1830, which is when Middlemarch is set, German scholarship had fully attained its European preeminence. Yet, at no time in German scholarship during the first two-thirds of the 19th century could a close partnership have developed between Orientalists and a protracted, sustained national interest in the Orient. There was nothing in Germany to correspond to the Anglo-French presence in India, the Levant, North Africa. Moreover, the German Orient was almost exclusively a scholarly, or at least a classical, Orient. It was made the subject of lyrics, fantasies, and even novels, but it was never actual, the way Egypt and Syria were actual for Chateaubriand, Lane, Lamartine, Burton, Disraeli, or Nerval. There is some significance in the fact that the two most renowned German works on the Orient, Goethe's Westöstliche Divan and Friedrich Schlegel's Über die Sprache und Weisheit der Indier, were based respectively on a Rhine journey and on hours spent in Paris libraries. What German Oriental scholarship did was to refine and elaborate techniques whose application was to texts, myths, ideas, and languages almost literally gathered from the Orient by Imperial Britain and France. Yet what German Orientalism had in common with Anglo-French and later American Orientalism was a kind of intellectual authority over the Orient within Western culture. This authority must in large part be the subject of any description of Orientalism, and it is so in this study. Even the name Orientalism suggests a serious, perhaps ponderous, style of expertise. When I apply it to modern American social scientists, since they do not call themselves Orientalists, my use of the word is anomalous, it is to draw attention to the way Middle East experts can still draw on the vestiges of Orientalism's intellectual position in 19th century Europe. There is nothing mysterious or natural about authority. It is formed, irradiated, disseminated. It is instrumental. It is persuasive. It has status. It establishes canons of taste and value. It is virtually indistinguishable from certain ideas it dignifies as true, and from traditions, perceptions, and judgments it forms, transmits, reproduces. Above all, authority can, indeed must, be analyzed. All these attributes of authority apply to Orientalism, and much of what I do in this study is to describe both the historical authority in and the personal authorities of Orientalism. My principal methodological devices for studying authority here are what can be called strategic location, which is a way of describing the author's position in a text with regard to the Oriental material he writes about, and strategic formation, which is a way of analyzing the relationship between texts and the way in which groups of texts, types of texts, even textual genres, acquire mass, density, and referential power among themselves and thereafter in the culture at large. I use the notion of strategy simply to identify the problem every writer on the Orient has faced, how to get hold of it, how to approach it, how not to be defeated or overwhelmed by its sublimity, its scope, its awful dimensions. Everyone who writes about the Orient must locate himself vis-à-vis the Orient. Translated into his text, this location includes the kind of narrative voice he adopts, the type of structure he builds, the kinds of images, themes, motifs that circulate in his text, all of which add up to deliberate ways of addressing the reader, containing the Orient, and finally, representing it or speaking in its behalf. None of this takes place in the abstract, however. Every writer on the Orient, and this is true even of Homer, assumes some Oriental precedent, some previous knowledge of the Orient to which he refers and on which he relies. Additionally, each work on the Orient affiliates itself with other works, with audiences, with institutions, with the Orient itself. The ensemble of relationships between works, audiences, and some particular aspects of the Orient therefore constitutes an analyzable formation, for example, that of philological studies, of anthologies of extracts from Oriental literature, of travel books, of Oriental fantasies, whose presence in time, in discourse, in institutions, schools, libraries, foreign services, gives it strength and authority. It is clear, I hope, that my concern with authority does not entail analysis of what lies hidden in the Orientalist text, but analysis rather of the text's surface, its exteriority to what it describes. I do not think that this idea can be overemphasized. Orientalism is premised upon exteriority, that is, on the fact that the Orientalist, poet or scholar, makes the Orient speak, describes the Orient, renders its mysteries plain for and to the West. He is never concerned with the Orient except as the first cause of what he says. What he says and writes, by virtue of the fact that it is said or written, is meant to indicate that the Orientalist is outside the Orient, both as an existential and as a moral fact. The principal product of this exteriority is, of course, representation. As early as Aeschylus's play, The Persians, the Orient is transformed from a very far, distant, and often threatening otherness into figures that are relatively familiar, in Aeschylus's case, grieving Asiatic women. The dramatic immediacy of representation in The Persians obscures the fact that the audience is watching a highly artificial enactment of what a non-Oriental has made into a symbol for the whole Orient. My analysis of the Orientalist text therefore places emphasis on the evidence, which is by no means invisible, for such representations as representations, not as natural depictions of the Orient. This evidence is found just as prominently in the so-called truthful text, histories, philological analyses, political treatises, as in the avowedly artistic, that is, openly imaginative text. The things to look at are style, figures of speech, setting, narrative devices, historical and social circumstances, not the correctness of the representation, nor its fidelity to some great original. The exteriority of the representation is always governed by some version of the truism that if the Orient could represent itself, it would. Since it cannot, the representation does the job, for the West, and faute de mieux, for the poor Orient. Sie können sich nicht vertreten, sie müssen vertreten werden, as Marx wrote in the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte. Another reason for insisting upon exteriority is that I believe it needs to be made clear about cultural discourse and exchange within a culture that what is commonly circulated by it is not truth, but representations. It hardly needs to be demonstrated again that language itself is a highly organized and encoded system, which employs many devices to express, indicate, exchange messages and information, represent, and so forth. In any instance of at least written language, there is no such thing as a delivered presence, but a re-presence or a representation. The value, efficacy, strength, apparent veracity of a written statement about the Orient therefore relies very little and cannot instrumentally depend on the Orient as such. On the contrary, the written statement is a presence to the reader by virtue of its having excluded, displaced, made supererogatory any such real thing as the Orient. Thus, all of Orientalism stands forth and away from the Orient. That Orientalism makes sense at all depends more on the West than on the Orient, and this sense is directly indebted to various Western techniques of representation that make the Orient visible, clear, there, in discourse about it. And these representations rely upon institutions, traditions, conventions, agreed upon codes of understanding for their effects, not upon a distant and amorphous Orient. The difference between representations of the Orient before the last third of the 18th century and those after it, that is, those belonging to what I call modern Orientalism, is that the range of representation expanded enormously in the later period. It is true that after William Jones and Anquetil du Perron, and after Napoleon's Egyptian expedition, Europe came to know the Orient more scientifically, to live in it with greater authority and discipline than ever before. But what mattered to Europe was the expanded scope and the much greater refinement given its techniques for receiving the Orient. When, around the turn of the 18th century, the Orient definitively revealed the age of its languages, thus outdating Hebrew's divine pedigree, it was a group of Europeans who made the discovery, passed it on to other scholars, and preserved the discovery in the new science of Indo-European philology. A new, powerful science for viewing the linguistic Orient was born, and with it, as Foucault has shown in The Order of Things, a whole web of related scientific interests. Similarly, William Beckford, Byron, Goethe, and Hugo restructured the Orient by their art and made its colors, lights, and people visible through their images, rhythms, and motifs. At most, the real Orient provoked a writer to his vision. It very rarely guided it. Orientalism responded more to the culture that produced it than to its putative object, which was also produced by the West. Thus, the history of Orientalism has both an internal consistency and a highly articulated set of relationships to the dominant culture surrounding it. My analyses, consequently, try to show the field's shape and internal organization, its pioneers, patriarchal authorities, canonical texts, doxological ideas, exemplary figures, its followers, elaborators, and new authorities. I try also to explain how Orientalism borrowed and was frequently informed by strong ideas, doctrines, and trends ruling the culture. Thus, there was and is a linguistic Orient, a Freudian Orient, a Spenglerian Orient, a Darwinian Orient, a racist Orient, and so on. Yet never has there been such a thing as a pure or unconditional Orient. Similarly, never has there been a non-material form of Orientalism, much less something so innocent as an idea of the Orient. In this underlying conviction and in its ensuing methodological consequences, do I differ from scholars who study the history of ideas. For the emphases and the executive form, above all the material effectiveness of statements made by Orientalist discourse, are possible in ways that any hermetic history of ideas tends completely to scant. Without those emphases and that material effectiveness, Orientalism would be just another idea, whereas it is and was much more than that. Therefore, I set out to examine not only scholarly works, but also works of literature, political tracts, journalistic texts, travel books, religious and philological studies. In other words, My hybrid perspective is broadly historical and anthropological, given that I believe all texts to be worldly and circumstantial in, of course, ways that vary from genre to genre and from historical period to historical period. Yet unlike Michel Foucault, to whose work I am greatly indebted, I do believe in the determining imprint of individual writers upon the otherwise anonymous collective body of texts constituting a discursive formation like Orientalism. The unity of the large ensemble of texts I analyze is due in part to the fact that they frequently refer to each other. Orientalism is, after all, a system for citing works and authors. Edward William Lane's Manners and Customs of the Modern Egyptians was read and cited by such diverse figures as Nerval, Flaubert, and Richard Burton. He was an authority whose use was an imperative for anyone writing or thinking about the Orient, not just about Egypt. When Nerval borrows passages verbatim from modern Egyptians, it is to use Lane's authority to assist him in describing village scenes in Syria, not Egypt. Lane's authority and the opportunities provided for citing him discriminately as well as indiscriminately were there because Orientalism could give his text the kind of distributive currency that he acquired. There is no way, however, of understanding Lane's currency without also understanding the peculiar features of his text. This is equally true of Renan, Sacy, Lamartine, Schlegel, and a group of other influential writers. Foucault believes that, in general, the individual text or author counts for very little, empirically, in the case of Orientalism, and perhaps nowhere else. I find this not to be so. Accordingly, my analyses employ close textual readings whose goal is to reveal the dialectic between individual text or writer and the complex collective formation to which his work is a contribution. Yet, even though it includes an ample selection of writers, this book is still far from a complete history or general account of Orientalism. Of this failing, I am very conscious. The fabric of as thick a discourse as Orientalism has survived and functioned in Western society because of its richness. All I have done is to describe parts of that fabric at certain moments, and merely to suggest the existence of a larger whole, detailed, interesting, dotted with fascinating figures, texts, and events. I have consoled myself with believing that this book is one installment of several, and hope there are scholars and critics who might want to write others. There is still a general essay to be written on imperialism and culture. Other studies would go more deeply into the connection between Orientalism and pedagogy, or into Italian, Dutch, German, and Swiss Orientalism, or into the dynamic between scholarship and imaginative writing, or into the relationship between administrative ideas and intellectual discipline. Perhaps the most important task of all would be to undertake studies in contemporary alternatives to Orientalism, to ask how one can study other cultures and peoples from a libertarian or a non-repressive and non-manipulative perspective. But then one would have to rethink the whole complex problem of knowledge and power. These are all tasks left embarrassingly incomplete in this study. The last, perhaps self-flattering, observation on method that I want to make here is that I have written this study with several audiences in mind. For students of literature and criticism, Orientalism offers a marvelous instance of the interrelations between society, history, and textuality. Moreover, the cultural role played by the Orient in the West connects Orientalism with ideology, politics, and the logic of power, matters of relevance, I think, to the literary community. For contemporary students of the Orient, from university scholars to policymakers, I have written with two ends in mind. One, to present their intellectual genealogy to them in a way that has not been done. Two, to criticize, with the hope of stirring discussion, the often unquestioned assumptions on which their work, for the most part, depends. For the general reader, this study deals with matters that always compel attention, all of them connected not only with Western conceptions and treatments of the other, but also with the singularly important role played by Western culture in what Vico called the World of Nations. Lastly, for readers in the so-called Third World, this study proposes itself as a step towards an understanding not so much of Western politics and of the non-Western world in those politics, as of the strength of Western cultural discourse, a strength too often mistaken as merely decorative or superstructural. My hope is to illustrate the formidable structure of cultural domination, and specifically for formerly colonized peoples, the dangers and temptations of employing this structure upon themselves or upon others. The three long chapters and 12 shorter units into which this book is divided are intended to facilitate exposition as much as possible. Chapter 1, The Scope of Orientalism, draws a large circle around all the dimensions of the subject, both in terms of historical time and experiences, and in terms of philosophical and political themes. Chapter 2, Orientalist Structures and Restructures, attempts to trace the development of modern Orientalism by a broadly chronological description, and also by the description of a set of devices common to the work of important poets, artists, and scholars. Chapter 3, Orientalism Now, begins where its predecessor left off, at around 1870. This is the period of great colonial expansion into the Orient, and it culminates in World War II. The very last section of Chapter 3 characterizes the shift from British and French to American hegemony. I attempt there, finally, to sketch the present intellectual and social realities of Orientalism in the United States. 3. The Personal Dimension. In The Prison Notebooks, Gramsci says, "The starting point of critical elaboration is the consciousness of what one really is, and is knowing thyself as a product of the historical process to date, which has deposited in you an infinity of traces, without leaving an inventory." The only available English translation inexplicably leaves Gramsci's comment at that, whereas in fact Gramsci's Italian text concludes by adding, "Therefore it is imperative at the outset to compile such an inventory." Much of the personal investment in this study derives from my awareness of being an Oriental as a child growing up in two British colonies. All of my education in those colonies, Palestine and Egypt, and in the United States, has been Western, and yet that deep, early awareness has persisted. In many ways, my study of Orientalism has been an attempt to inventory the traces upon me, the Oriental subject, of the culture whose domination has been so powerful a factor in the life of all Orientals. This is why, for me, the Islamic Orient has had to be the center of attention. Whether what I have achieved is the inventory prescribed by Gramsci is not for me to judge, although I have felt it important to be conscious of trying to produce one. Along the way, as severely and as rationally as I have been able, I have tried to maintain a critical consciousness, as well as employing those instruments of historical, humanistic, and cultural research of which my education has made me the fortunate beneficiary. In none of that, however, have I ever lost hold of the cultural reality of the personal involvement in having been constituted as an Oriental. The historical circumstances making such a study possible are fairly complex, and I can only list them schematically here. Anyone resident in the West since the 1950s, particularly in the United States, will have lived through an era of extraordinary turbulence in the relations of East and West. No one will have failed to note how East has always signified danger and threat during this period, even as it has meant the traditional Orient as well as Russia. In the universities, a growing establishment of area studies programs and institutes has made the scholarly study of